This is 91.3 KUAF, your source for NPR news and programs since 1985, and this is Ozarks at Large for Friday, June 16th, 2017. I'm Kyle Kellhams. We'll begin this edition of Ozarks, as we do many Fridays, by asking Michael Tilley from Talk Business and Politics to help us analyze the news of the week, except today we'll be discussing the events of what are, as we begin our conversation, just the events of the past hour or so. Michael, good to talk to you.
Well, it's good to talk to you. It's you certainly know how to plan your interviews right around breaking news, that's for sure.
Well, Amazon is buying Whole Foods. Walmart is buying Bonobos. How do we keep pace with what's happening in retail?
You don't. I don't think you do. Or that's your full-time job. If you do, that's your full-time job. But look, I remember back when Walmart and Target were going after it, and people would used to joke that Target and Walmart would at some point be the only two retailers left in the U.S. Well, I think that may be partially true, but I think it may be Amazon and Walmart may be the only two retailers left. They've made big moves into each other's business, and today was probably the biggest, and on the same day. Amazon is buying Whole Foods for $13.7 billion. That's about a 27% premium above their market capitalization as of Thursday. And then Walmart, and this has not been a secret, it's been rumored, but buying the specialty retailer Bonobos, I've heard it pronounced many different ways, for $310 million. And, Walmart started this aggressive online specialty acquisition with Jet.com back about 10 months ago. And that was a $3.3 billion deal. And since then, they bought Moose Jaw, Shoe Buy, Mod Cloth, and now this. They're getting into Amazon's business with these specialty deals, and now Amazon's getting into the food business. And was watching Jim Cramer on CNBC just a few minutes ago, and he is rarely at loss for words.
Right.
He was even somewhat, just kind of flummoxed. You could just kind of see it. And he said, and I'll read the quote to make sure I get it correctly. He said, and this, he's talking about the Amazon buying Whole Foods. He said, this is a game changer. This is what everybody thought could happen. They will now dominate food within the next 2 years. And I'm not saying he's correct with that assessment. But you know that there are, I can't imagine how many hastily called meetings happened this morning in Bentonville to respond to this news.
So, okay, Amazon has Whole Foods. So does that mean that when this all gets together, that no matter where you are, you might be able to get flax seeds or unsweetened coconut delivered to you in 24 hours?
I think yes is the answer. And I think that's what... who knows what products will be and how long it will be, but that is what I think Cramer was referring to as a game changer. This opens up the doors to all kinds of possibilities. Now, look, Walmart still has, Walmart still has a big advantage over Amazon, even with the Whole Foods footprint, because that footprint is nowhere near the 4,600 plus stores, which doesn't count Sam's Club, that Walmart has. And Walmart recently announced they will begin using some of their employees to do that last mile delivery, which is the most it's the most costly part of the whole process if you're really going to deliver, getting from a store or a fulfillment center to a home. That's the where a large part of the cost is. So if Walmart can figure that out using its large physical footprint before Amazon, that's what they have to do if they're going to stay ahead of the game. So now it's a race to the door. It's a race to Kyle Kellum's door. It's a race to Michael Tilley's door, And so who's going to get there first and who's going to make it cost effective? But I think Walmart, though, like I said, with the physical stores, is well capitalized. Well, not that Amazon's not, but it's definitely, this is an Ollie Frazier fight.
Well, okay, so this is a question that perhaps would be better geared towards the Talk Business and Politics Minneapolis Bureau, but where is Target in all of this?
They're just, you know, one of the things that's been interesting, and I'm going to get around to your answering this question, is Walmart and Amazon have done fairly well in a retail environment that has really stunk it up the last few quarters. So Target is trying to get, you know, we talked a few months ago, and Target had announced a new strategy for online. And if you remember, I said these strategy components that Target's laying out are very similar to what Doug McMillon laid out 3 or 4 years ago. So Target, to answer your question, Target has a lot of catching up to do. They see now that Walmart may have had part of the right answer, and they're pursuing that strategy. So we'll see how quickly they can catch up. Their disadvantage is they don't have the footprint, they don't have the capital, they don't have the cash flow that a Walmart does. So they're going to have to be very clever, find some kind of niche. Look, Target's not going to go away anytime soon, but they are definitely going to have to swim faster to keep up.
All right, one other question. So if the race is now to our front doors, who can get there? Who can get there faster and more conveniently? What if there is another spike in oil prices? Because these things that have to get to my door rely on jet fuel and motor fuels in vans. What then?
Then you've invested well in Tesla.
All right.
I'm serious. You know, and Volt and Chevy and CNG. You know, so that's, I think that's where you can handle that. And look, oil is not irrelevant. You know, the price of oil is not irrelevant, but it's not as relevant as it used to be toward, you know, the economic dynamic. You know, it used to be that you could essentially track the health of an economy by tracking the price of a barrel of oil, and that's not as easy to do anymore.
All right. Well, that's one, a couple of things that developed over the last hour and a half.
Well,
there's more from Bentonville that's developed this morning, right?
Yeah, this is surprising. The Bentonville, Greater Bentonville area, which used to be the Bentonville Bella Vista Chamber, but the Greater Bentonville Area Chamber President and CEO Dana Davis has retired. He's been there 4 years. He came from North Texas in college. We literally, you and I both got this press release as we began this interview. It doesn't say why he's leaving. It may just be that he is at retirement age and is moving on. But for most, by most accounts, and I've known him since he's been here, he's had a good career. He's had a successful career at Bentonville. He appears to be well-liked. I have not heard any negatives. And usually if you're in a chamber job, you're, what people think about you is eventually going to get back to the media, but I've not heard anything negative about him. So I hate to see him go. I think it's somewhat of a loss for the chamber, but that chamber has proven, you know, resilient. You know, Dana succeeded Mr. Clifford and Ed Clifford, and Ed did a hell of a job getting that chamber up on its feet, making it relevant in the community, and Dana continued that. And I'm confident that chamber board will find someone that can keep that momentum going.
And finally, we had some home sales numbers this week as well.
Yes, good news for the Fort Smith metro area. Home sales, they dipped in May, but still year on year for Sebastian and Crawford County, they're up a little over 6% in terms of the number of homes sold and the volume, the sales volume. The price, so to speak, is almost 10% up. And that is, that's good news. It's builds upon what was a good 2016. So for 2017 numbers to still be this healthy, that's a good sign. And I'm somewhat surprised that the home sales numbers in the two counties continue to be as good as they are, and very good, because the job numbers in the metro area have frankly been a disappointment so far this year. So, and typically those numbers kind of fall in line. So it'll be interesting to see how the second half of the year goes for home sales and or for the job numbers.
All right. Michael Tilley is with Talk Business and Politics. You can find out much more about this and many of the things we've talked about today, of course, aren't fully developed. Follow at talkbusiness.net. Michael, I'll talk to you again on Monday.
Okay. Look forward to it.
And ahead on today's Ozarks, not that much is written for a duet of violin and flute, but thankfully, Mozart did his contribution. In our second half hour, Indigo Fisher and Rebecca Paddock play for us from inside the Furman Garner Performance Studio. That's ahead on today's Ozarks at Large.
Come along as we troll for salmon in Alaska.
We're fishing. Let's start catching.
Where life lessons are passed from father to daughter.
I remember when I was first learning how to fish, getting my gear tangled up, and then Dad would have to come fix it, and oh no, I've messed up.
A fishing expedition, Saturday on Weekend Edition from NPR News.
Weekend Edition Saturday, fishing and more tomorrow morning from 7 to 9 on 91.3 KUAF. Celebrating 21 years in Northwest Arkansas, Community Clinic has served as the medical home for thousands of insured and uninsured patients in Northwest Arkansas, providing health care in 14 locations, including Springdale, Rogers, Siloam Springs, Fayetteville, Lincoln, and Prairie Grove. Healthy people, healthy community. CommunityClinicNWA.org. Support for KUAF comes from the Northwest Arkansas Business Journal, now featuring technology and telecoms, plus local business news from Northwest Arkansas. Subscriptions and information available at 725-0394 or nwabusinessjournal.com. This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Kellums. A major disaster declaration has been issued by the federal government for the state of Arkansas. Governor Asa Hutchinson requested the designation from President Trump's administration following storms and floods that hit much of the state from late April to mid-May. The declaration opens up federal dollars to assist individuals in 13 counties, including Benton, Boone, Carroll, and Washington. Federal dollars can also be used to repair damaged public infrastructure and facilities in 28 counties. Arkansas Department of Emergency Management Director A.J. Gary says the designation is needed.
The flooding is so large that it goes beyond what the resources are of the state. So we will request a federal declaration so that it'll open up those funds that can be used, federal funds.
The state, assisted by the Federal Emergency Management Agency, will soon open up offices in affected counties for residents and local governments to apply for assistance. Gary says it's impossible to project any estimates for assistance at this point, but the applications will be accepted during a 60-day window. Attorneys representing Mayflower residents affected by a 2013 pipeline rupture say they've settled a lawsuit with ExxonMobil. The rupture spilled an estimated 150,000 gallons of heavy crude oil. The law firm Hare, Wynn, Newell & Newton says the settlement was favorable to the residents. According to a news release, 64 families were involved in the settlement that resulted from a lawsuit filed in Faulkner County Circuit Court in 2013. Exxon has already paid out $5 million in other settlements with state and federal entities. And the Environmental Protection Agency is awarding $75,000 to the Cherokee Nation of Oklahoma as part of the General Assistance Program. According to a news release, the tribe will use the funds to administer its environmental program and assist in the development of multimedia programs to address environmental issues. The General Assistance Program protects the health of the Cherokee Nation by safeguarding the environment through awareness and environmental program development.
That's Cannonball Adderley and Bill Evans. Hi, I'm Robert Ginsburg, your host for Shades of Jazz, every Friday night from 10 till midnight on 91.3 and on KUAF HD Radio from 11 a.m. till 1 p.m. on Saturday. We'll hear more from Cannonball. We'll also hear from Sonny Clark, Helio Alves, Keith Jackson, and Lee Tambulian. Shades of Jazz here on KUAF.
Joyce Faulkner is a Fort Smith native. She also writes historical fiction. And she's just released a new novel. It's called Vala's Bed. She's written several novels. This latest is based in a time right after the Holocaust. Ozarks at Large's Zuzanna Sitek spoke with Faulkner about her work.
In writing historical fiction, while parts of it are fiction, the rest is based on true events. So how do you approach that historical side of it?
Well, in my first historical fiction, which is In the Shadow of Suribachi, it's about the Battle of Iwo Jima. And my father fought there. One of my earliest memories is sitting in his lap, he's showing me pictures that were taken on Iwo Jima. So I had a kind of a running start. I had a good idea of what happened there. It was very easy at the time I was writing it. My father had long passed on, but there were lots of men who had served there who were veterans. And they were just beginning to be ready to tell their stories. So whenever possible, I do like to talk to people. I like to go to things like after-action reports and any documentation that the military might have if it's a military subject. And I really like going back and looking at not only books and magazines and things that are written specifically to analyze an event or a topic, but to look at the letters to the editor, because there you can get a feel how people of the time spoke, the jargon, the things they were interested in, their biases. So it's a lot of footwork to do historical fiction.
So how do you pick, I guess? Is it just sort of, are you just inspired to pick a certain world event and then develop your own story, or how does that process work?
Inevitably, a story has captured me in some way. Interestingly enough, the new one called Vala's Bed happened because my husband and I had, I had just retired from industry, and my husband had an assignment in Mannheim, Germany. And it was the first time I got to go with him and to explore on my own. And as I was wandering around this beautiful, beautiful city, I realized suddenly that it had been, pretty much destroyed during World War II. And during that exploration, it suddenly dawned on me that I didn't see a thriving Jewish community. The thing that came to my mind is what happened to the Jews of Mannheim. I found out that Jews of Mannheim had actually mostly died in Auschwitz. As soon as I realized that, I thought, well, while I'm in Mannheim, I need to see Auschwitz. And so we took the train, through Germany into Poland, from the point that we got into Poland into smaller and smaller trains. The last train, literally, when we got to Auschwitz, which is the Polish name for the town that Auschwitz was built around, and Auschwitz is the German name for Auschwitz. It literally was the end of the line. The next morning, we go to Auschwitz. We go to Auschwitz 1, which is a very profound place to be. And up above, on the second or third floor, is a museum. Mm-hmm. And in the museum is a very long case of, on both sides, a glass case of hair. And we walk into it, and we're looking around, and it's mostly dark hair, gray hair. I had red hair. And as we walked in, my husband spotted one red ponytail at the top. And it was just like, he was overwhelmed. Our guide stepped back and let him get his breath, and he recovered. And we went downstairs and we went to Auschwitz II. Mm-hmm. And Auschwitz II is Birkenau. Yeah. And it's the one that you recognize where the train goes through the arch and they had mm-hmm. the lecture. And behind the ruins of the crematory and the gas chambers is a long, low building, and that's where people went who were selected to live. And we saw where they tattooed people, and we saw where they shaved their hair. And in the very last room, there was a bunch of pictures hanging on bulletin boards. So they're hanging up, and we're walking around them, and we're looking at these photos of people that had been here. And like the last bulletin board, I caught a sight of a picture of a woman who looked like my mother. And again, it was that, you know. And I turned to the guide, and I said, who is that? And then he said, that's Rosa Kovatovich. So apparently they have mapped out many people, and they know who they were. Mm-hmm. And I was just entranced. And I'm looking at all of these pictures. There's some where she's getting married, and there's a picture of her with her baby. And I turned to him again, and I said, what happened to her? And, of course, the answer was just heartbreaking. And the reality that these were real people. And, you know, I couldn't get my mind around millions, but I could get my mind around one young woman who looked like my mother. Mm-hmm. And at that point, I felt like I needed to write this book.
So how did you approach writing about something as sensitive as the Holocaust?
Well, one of the things that I felt as I left, and you have to understand that I wasn't Jewish, I'm not Polish, I'm not involved in any way in that. You know, I'm a boomer. I'm American. And my instinct was, regardless, I felt incredibly guilty that somehow we had a world where such things could happen. And I had nightmares for a long time. But I was intrigued about those folks in Germany who may have been involved in a tangential way, or who may have been the children of people who were involved in one way or another. And the more I explored this topic, the more I realized there wasn't much written about it from that point of view. How do you live beyond that? Mm-hmm. The core concept of Ballested is that we have a German war bride and her two children, and they are brought to Mid-America. This was something I started in 2002, and it's taken me this long to finish it because of, you know, how much research there is to do for the Holocaust. But the story is told from her oldest son's point of view, and he's trying to understand being brought up in now a mid-America, mid-20th century values, how his mother, you know, could, what she believed and what she felt and whatever. And I was very intrigued by that concept because when you are submersed in one message, it starts to sound right. And I am sure many people in Germany itself, born in different eras, have such different perspectives than that short group of people who were born in just about the time frame that the Nuremberg Laws came in. I want to talk about the cover.
Oh, yes, absolutely. Yeah. Let's talk about the cover of the book. I heard it's a local artist or a Fort Smith artist.
When I started school at the Immaculate Conception in 1955, her name is Aurora Costas. And Aurora was an immigrant from the Philippines. And she didn't start class with us until the third grade. Mm-hmm. I have a distinct memory of her in the first grade, which I chuckle about because she wasn't there. But she had made that big of an impression on me as a child. When I met her last year, I thought, oh, my goodness, what better person to create Vala than another immigrant.
Yeah.
You know, granted from a different place, but how does it feel to be here and having been and lived in another culture, and especially in wartime?
Yeah.
So I asked her, and Aurora's history in art has been, you know, for like fashion drawing, mm-hmm. you know, how they would do the pictures of, you know, a clothes and
yeah.
And that was her, you know, very realistic look. Mm-hmm. And she had already booked a model to do Vala.
Okay.
And then she read the book and decided to do an abstract version of it.
Wow.
And it is just stunning. When she sent me the painting, I was just like, I couldn't have imagined anything better, you know?
So you are actually working toward a novel about Fort Smith. Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
I'm looking at this point in history between, say, 1895 and 1910 or 1915 is my goal.
Okay.
And we're currently doing the timeline. I always start out for historical fiction. The first thing I do is the timeline that actually what happens in this area.
Mm-hmm.
And then after I've got everything, you know, on my timeline that really did happen.
Yeah.
Then I do the timeline for the characters that I've created over top of it. The people here in town have offered me resources and opportunities to talk with local historians, and they've, you know, given me good ideas and suggestions and where to look and that kind of thing. So it'll be a little bit easier here than some other places where I have to go and, you know, make contacts.
Absolutely. And so I imagine there are many trips to Fort Smith in your future.
There will be.
That's exciting.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it. I've enjoyed chatting with you.
Ozarks at Large's Zuzanna Sitek speaking with writer Joyce Faulkner. She was born and raised in Fort Smith, now lives in Pittsburgh. She was in the area this week to do a book signing and a visit with former classmates. This is Ozarks at Large. It is Friday, June 16th, 2017. With me is Becca Martin Brown, features editor at the Northwest Arkansas Democrat Gazette. Welcome back.
Hi there. Let's talk about cell phones.
Okay. They've been around for a while.
Great quotes. There are only one or two sacred places left in the world where there is no ringing.
Mm.
You'll never walk alone because you'll always have a machine in your pants that might ring.
It's true.
I want to remember everything, even other people's memories. Remembering requires paper. Mm. The play is called Dead Man's Cell Phone.
Oh, it's in Rogers.
Opens this weekend at Arkansas Public Theater in Rogers. It's a Sarah Rule play, who also wrote Eurydice, which has been everywhere lately.
Right.
Okay, here's the premise. Girl is sitting in a restaurant. Guy's cell phone starts to ring at, like, the next table. And rings and rings and rings and stops and rings some more. And he doesn't answer it. So she gets up to go over to say, "Answer your phone." And he's dead.
Hence the name of the title, or
exactly.
Hence the name of the play. Yeah.
And she ends up taking custody of the cell phone. And the play's 10 or 15 years old. So she's never had a cell phone. This is the first cell phone she's had. And suddenly she realizes, because she's answering the phone all the time, telling his business acquaintances he's dead, talking to his wife and his mother and his mistress. And she realizes the obligation of having this cell phone. And yeah, it brings her together with all these people. But then she meets somebody that she really likes, and the cell phone keeps interrupting. As yeah, and she said, "Well, if it's ringing, you have to answer it."
Yeah, right.
No, you don't. It makes you think about a lot of things. It's not a complicated play as far as... And it has this sort of Edward Albee, Bertolt Brecht feel to it, that kind of ethereal. 8 o'clock today and tomorrow, 2 on Sunday, again next weekend at Arkansas Public Theater. Tickets start at $23. Also this weekend, still kind of following our "you might not know about these things" script, the Arts Center of the Ozarks is doing a thing with Melbourne-based theater company Born in a Taxi. They're doing this thing twice in downtown Springdale. They're doing it at 11 o'clock tomorrow at the Farmers Market. And then they're doing it tomorrow evening during one of the Western Days events that are part of Rodeo of the Ozarks.
Which is earlier than it used to be.
Yes, it is, and it's so confusing. So the one at 11 o'clock is called The Curious Game. It's an interactive piece commissioned for an Alice in Wonderland festival in Australia. And the one in the evening is called Zebras. I like the idea of a zebra wandering up to me in the crowd.
Well, and that's it. That fits with the Rodeo of the Ozarks time frame, right?
It does. Zebra's
a horse.
In a stripey kind of way.
Sure.
So 11 o'clock tomorrow and between 7 and 8 tomorrow, both, well, essentially on Emma Avenue. The Springdale Farmers Market is on Mill Street. The Western Days events take place on Emma Avenue, and both are free. And then we're getting ready for, whoever thought, okay, the first time I came to Northwest Arkansas.
Mm-hmm.
I had a cousin who had a place in Bella Vista, you know, a weekend place. And I came down to visit, and we went into Bentonville to try to find a place to eat.
Right.
And it was after dark on a Friday or Saturday. And I think that there was like a Waffle House or something open.
Right.
Now we have this event called Bite Northwest Arkansas.
Yeah.
And this is new this year. They're going to have something called the Chef's Table Experience that takes place on Thursday. And one of the guests is Dean Fearing, who's the creator of Fearing's Restaurant at the Ritz-Carlton in Dallas, and author of the Texas Food Bible, and one of the fathers of Southwestern cuisine. And there are going to be other chefs participating, too. The James Beard Foundation is curating it. And so what happens is that these chefs are going to cook for you to see on stage. But the folks involved with Bite Northwest Arkansas are going to make sure you get to taste things, too. And then on the next night, this is all part of the LPGA tour that stops here in June. Now it's the same week as Rodeo of the Ozarks. Talk to my sports folks. So the first night is the Chef's Table Experience on Thursday. The second night on Friday is burgers and beer, local beer. And both of them happen from 6 to 9 at the new 8th Street Market in Bentonville. $30 a ticket, bitenwa.com to find out more. And then also this weekend is the Arkansas New Play Festival at Theater Squared, although this weekend's events are happening at Crystal Bridges. So tonight at 5:30, visible from four states is one of the new plays. And then Transatlantic follows at 7:30 at Crystal Bridges. And then on Saturday, you can choose Airport Day at the Arkansas Air and Military Museum. You can choose an open house at Headquarters House in Fayetteville. You can choose Family Saturday at the Shiloh Museum, which is a World War I soldier's life with Doug Kidd, the reenactor.
And this is intended for families.
Yes.
Yeah.
Super Saturday at the Fayetteville Public Library with Brian and Terry Kinder. Saturday afternoon music at 2 at the Fayetteville Public Library with the Ozark Saxophone Quartet. And then tomorrow evening, the Arkansas New Play Festival is back at Crystal Bridges with the Furies at 2 o'clock and Comet Town at 4:30. And tomorrow night, Chihuly Saturday Nights at Crystal Bridges with Smokey in the Mirror.
Your sports guys who are already trying to juggle LPGA.
And rodeo.
I mean, had the Razorbacks made it to Omaha for the College World Series?
Oh, golly. Don't even say that to any of them. They would just weep.
Okay.
And you guys figuring out what to do means you should go get a copy of What's Up.
There you go.
Because it's all laid out there in front of you. It's in today's paper.
Fair enough.
There you go.
Set you back, what, a dollar?
Well, and if you're really cheap, you can go get a copy of the free weekly.
I'm trying to help this industry. All right. Becca Barton Brown is features editor, but not the marketing manager for the Northwest Arkansas Democrat Gazette.
On this week's On the Media, a current production of Julius Caesar depicts the murdered Caesar as Trump. Delta Airlines pulled its support, citing the play's conflict with its corporate values.
Does Delta support cross-dressing in the woods with fairies? Does Delta support falling in love with your mother and getting upset about your father's ghosts? Like, what? There's no Shakespeare play that's appropriate to corporate values.
On this week's On the Media from WNYC.
On the Media, Sunday morning at 11 on 91.3 KUAF. Springdale is beginning a new summer tradition by bringing music performances to the newly reopened Murphy Park after a long renovation. It's one of the oldest parks in Springdale. It reopened in May with new fountains in the pond and a large pavilion that will be used for the Music in Murphy series. Vernon Tarver is the director of marketing for Parks and Rec. He says Springdale wanted to keep the energy going after the reopening celebration in May.
Kind of an idea that we had is just growing Murphy Park and growing community events in Springdale and in our area. When we built this big event pavilion in Murphy Park, we wanted to do something just kind of as an entire summer series. We're going to have not only these music events, we're doing movies in the park as well.
Tarver says tonight's free performance goes from 7 to 9 p.m. It will feature Smokey and the Mirror.
Kind of a folk bluegrass duo, husband and wife group out of Fayetteville.
He says Kona Ice will also be there to sell shaved ice during the show. The next Music in Murphy concert with the Full House Band will be held July 21st. And coming up on June 30th, there will be an outdoor screening of Lego Batman. Tarver says this is just the beginning.
And then we're going to definitely add more movies and more music as we continue to grow this. But that's the plan for our music and movie series this first summer.
And that pond at Murphy Park, by the way, restocked with fish last Friday. In the world of classical music, there aren't many combinations written for flute and violin duets. Both instruments live in the higher tonal range. But this weekend, a recital in Eureka Springs will feature that exact combination. Flutist Indigo Fisher and violinist Rebecca Paddock will perform Sunday evening at Eureka Unitarian Universalist Fellowship in Eureka Springs. The two came to the Carver Center for Public Radio earlier this week to talk with Ozarks at Large's Timothy Dennis. And they give us a preview of what to expect at their Sunday recital. Before that conversation, we'll hear the two performing Mozart. This is from The Magic Flute.
So, first of all, tell me how you two came together to perform these duos at this recital this weekend.
Well, I work at a cafe in Eureka Springs, and Indigo's mother works next door, and she came into the cafe and was talking about Indigo and how she goes to music school in Colorado, and I was excited that she'd be coming back to town for the summer, so I asked her if she would like to perform a concert together.
And you said yes.
I obviously said yes. I said, yes! is? There are not many classical musicians in Eureka since it's a town of 2,100 people. So I really never get to play with anyone while I'm home. So it's been a treat to actually have another partner in crime to play with.
What does that do for you when you get to play when you come home?
Well, it's so motivating. I'm a busy, busy person, so I love to just be doing things all the time. And it gives me a great goal while I'm home to be preparing for this recital, to be working on the music, to be scheduling the rehearsals, arranging a lot of our music, getting all the promo ready, getting the programs ready. It's definitely been keeping me busy, and I've loved that.
So you've been playing flute for several years. Tell me a bit about kind of how you've progressed in your flute playing.
Well, I started flute in the fifth grade band, and I chose the flute over the clarinet. Those were the only two band instruments I really knew about, and I knew the flute was shinier and therefore prettier, so I chose it. And it stuck with me, and I'm glad it has, because I'm making it my career now professionally. In eighth grade, I started taking private lessons, and that completely changed my life, and it really made me want to pursue this in a more challenged way. And I transferred schools twice, and the second transfer was to Interlochen Arts Academy, which is a boarding arts high school in Interlochen, Michigan. And I went there for 2 years, and that also completely changed my life, and it set me on my track now and helped me prepare for college auditions. So I auditioned for and was accepted to University of Colorado Boulder, where I am now, and I'm studying with one of my dream flute players, Professor Christina Jennings. I call her a flute goddess because she is, and she inspires me every time I hear her play in every lesson. I'm so happy to be there.
And where do you want to go with your flute studies?
I would love to be doing exactly what my professor's doing, so either teaching at a high-tier university as a flute professor or at a conservatory, and also having a very active performance life, either in a regional orchestra, wherever I'm based, or with a chamber ensemble, such as what I'm doing with Rebecca.
So, Rebecca, you were in here earlier this year as part of Sad Daddy, a band you play with in Eureka, in Arkansas, throughout the region. It's a folk band, an old-time folk band, but these are classical songs that you're playing. How challenging is it to switch between folk and classical?
Well, I grew up playing classical, so it's nice to get back to what I've done probably the longest period of my life. I think it is challenging to switch between the two because a lot of the styles are different. I probably play more rhythmically, and slower vibrato are certain examples of how folk music is different than classical, and a lot faster notes in some of the classical music and different techniques and stuff like that. But I still feel like the goal is the same, to like have fun and hopefully make people who come to the concert feel something or have a good experience at the concert. So,
do you feel that getting to perform classical music helps inform your folk playing as well?
Definitely. And I think any kind of music, because you're just trying to express emotions or get across something to the audience and try to change their mood or things like that. So also just the technique behind the instrument is a lot of it is the same. So if you already know how to play all the notes on the violin, so it's easy to translate it over to a folk song.
Okay. So earlier we were talking about, or y'all were talking about, how pieces with flute and violin are kind of rare. How are you getting around that?
Well, we've been finding some of our favorite classical pieces and arranging them for flute and violin. And the reason behind there not being a lot of repertoire for the two instruments is because they're the highest pitched instruments in an orchestra, for example. They're both treble instruments, very shrill, and there's really no harmony in a lot of flute violin because we're playing the melody. So we've been having to arrange pieces in order to have one of us playing the harmony while the other is doing the melody. And something that's been very challenging is tuning, because these two instruments are up in the high register. You know, your ears might get a little hurt hearing some of our notes sometimes because they're so high. So it's very difficult to tune up in that higher stratosphere of the instruments. And I think that's a big reason that there isn't a lot of repertoire for them. Not that we cannot sound beautiful together, because we do, especially when we've arranged these pieces to really complement with harmony and melody at the same time.
So is it freeing or just different hearing these pieces without, you know, those lower voices mixed in there?
It's different. It's maybe not freeing. That's not maybe the right word, but it's definitely not any worse without it. I think we're doing just fine without the bassists or the cellists playing along with us, because we still do have harmony with our pieces. And the violin and the flute individually are such amazing, flashy, virtuosic instruments that when you put them together, it's like a match made in heaven.
So tell me about this recital that's taking place Sunday.
So our recital is this Sunday, June 18th at 7 p.m. It'll be at the Eureka Unitarian Universalist Fellowship in Eureka Springs. Tickets are $12 at the door, and we are going to have an amazing program of the Mozart that you heard today from the Magic Flute. We're going to be playing some Vivaldi, some Bach, and maybe even an Irish jig.
So an Irish jig.
Yeah, it's going to be a great program. That's been fun. That's been really fun to work on.
So you two haven't been playing together for very long. How has it been to get acquainted with each other musically?
It's been exciting. We've been kind of rehearsing almost every other day or every day for the last couple weeks. And just to get to know Indigo and work together has been great. We have a beautiful space that we practice, and it's just been exciting to get to work hard on something and have a goal to work towards, and we're excited for the concert. I think the music is really accessible to anyone, even if they're not used to going to a classical music concert, sort of like a lot of the hits.
Yeah,
and like,
you'll recognize
They're shorter, like, duration songs, so it's kind of like...
They're very approachable pieces.
Approachable pieces that anyone could... like feel something too, or imagine something in their mind, a scene going on in their mind too. So I'm excited about all the music we're playing.
So this piece is the Flower Duet from the opera Lakmé by Leo Delibes.
Indigo, Rebecca, thank you so much for coming in today.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
That was flutist Indigo Fisher and violinist Rebecca Paddock performing inside the Furman Garner Performance Studio at KUAF. Their recital takes place 7 p.m. Sunday at the Eureka Unitarian Universalist Fellowship. That's on Elk Street in Eureka Springs.
When NPR first went on the air on May 3rd, 1971, there were 30 employees and one program director. His name was Bill Seemering.
I remember talking to the staff saying, you know, we've got this blank canvas here, and there are going to be a lot of brushstrokes in this, but the ones that we put on first are going to be very important, because that's going to set the style and tone and color of what we're doing.
Bill Siemering was there at the beginning. He wrote NPR's mission statement, and one of his first jobs was figuring out who public radio was for.
National Public Radio will serve the individual. It will promote personal growth. It will regard individual differences with respect and joy rather than derision and hate.
That's Bill reading NPR's mission statement. Listeners were front and center from the very beginning.
It's a sacred trust we have with the listeners to broadcast the truth, you know? Otherwise, it's like operating with unsterile instruments or giving people polluted water. It makes them ill. So I wanted the journalism to be 100% first. That was most important.
It's been 50 years since public broadcasting began. 50 years of stations like this one, holding fast to the core principles of reliable, fact-based journalism. If you've listened for 5 months, 5 years, or all 50, and you haven't given to public radio, now is the time. Stand with the facts. Stand with this station. And thank you.
You can find out more about KUAF and all of our stations at KUAF.com. You can find out more about contributing to KUAF at supportkuaf.com. 91.3 is supported by Crystal Bridges Museum of American Art, celebrating the American spirit by uniting the power of art with the beauty of nature. The museum and its restaurant 11 are open until 9 p.m. on Wednesdays, Thursdays, and Fridays. Online reservations for dinner available at crystalbridges.org/11. From Down Under to downtown Springdale, the Art Center of the Ozarks presents two interactive theater events June 17th. The Curious Game is at 11 a.m. during the downtown Springdale Farmers Market, and the Prancing and Roaming Zebras will perform between 4 and 6 p.m. at Shiloh Square. acozarks.org for more information. The Northwest Arkansas Tobacco and Drug-Free Coalition presents a smoke-free experience at Arkansas's LGBTQ celebration, NWA Pride Week, June 16th through the 25th. The annual Pride Parade is Saturday, June 24th at 11 a.m. on Dixon Street. Immediately following the parade, the festival will continue at the Fayetteville Town Center Plaza on the downtown square. NWAEquality.org for more information. This is 91.3 FM KUAF Public Radio in Fayetteville, Fort Smith, Bentonville, and Alma. Big thanks to Washington County Historical Society for inviting me last Sunday to spend part of their observation of Arkansas Statehood Day with them. I was honored to have a conversation with Governor Jim Guy Tucker in front of an audience. We talked about his father, who served in World War I, and the effect of World War I on Arkansas. Also there that day was Garrett Kramer Wright, a research archivist at the University of Arkansas, Little Rock. Plus, should mention the great music that Clark Buehling had to start the show. So thanks to the Washington County Historical Society for that. And big thanks to Don Nelms and Sunrise Stage last night for allowing me to have the honor to introduce the Cate Brothers to an audience last night. Got to ask the Cates a couple of questions. It was a lot of fun. Thanks so much. I'll see you tonight at the Black Apple Awards on the deck on Dixon Street. I'm Kyle Kellums. Thanks so much for listening. Don't forget, Weekend Ozarks, Sunday morning at 9. Oh, and more great local programming ahead on this Friday on KUAF 91.3. Paul Kelso and the Generic Blues Show tonight and every Friday night at 9 o'clock. And then Robert Ginsburg and Shades of Jazz tonight from 10 to midnight. And if you miss them tonight because you're busy, don't worry. KUAF 3 gives you opportunities to hear both shows again on the weekend. Shades of Jazz, Saturday morning from 11 till Saturday afternoon at 1 on KUAF 3. And Generic Blues Show with Paul Kelso can be heard Sunday evenings at 6 on 91.3. If you'd like to see the entire KUAF 3 lineup for the weekend, which includes encore productions of all of our locally produced music shows, you can go to KUAF.com. Have a great rest of your Friday.